You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is Herds, and we are talking...
And Cam.
He's also here, and we are talking about It Takes a Town by Aoife Clifford, chapters 12 to 24. It is the middle episode out of the three that we're doing, and there's a lot going on. We're watching our supposed protagonist Frankie's life fall apart before her own eyes.
Oh, poor Frankie.
And the conspiracy surrounding Vanessa's death and Jazz Langridge's disappearance come into full frame. Now, Cam, you're the one who's solving this. You don't know entirely what's going on, but I'd like to get your impressions on Jazz's harebrained scheme to concoct her own disappearance.
This is just insanity. All credit to Aoife Clifford. It didn't read that way at all until it was sort of spelled out for you in one of Jazz's chapters, where in the initial kidnapping scene, like her reactions felt genuine reading through it. And then there's another quick scene of her trying to sleep and she's uncomfortable. She's cold.
She has to pee in a bucket. It's awful. Yeah.
She has to pee in a bucket. And it's like, damn, she's really going through it. And then I think the third chapter on like short chapter on Jazz, it's like, oh, abducted in inverted commas. And I sort of took me out of the book for a second. I was like, wait a second.
That's cool.
What is this?
She kind of explains through her internal monologue because she doesn't really have scenes with other characters at this point because she's been, quote, abducted, as you say. But she explains that in order to fool the police in the future and make everything kind of convincing, she has attempted to convince herself that the lie is real. And that's why the chapters that we've seen of her being abducted are written in such a way that she's trying to convince herself that the whole kidnapping thing is real, even though, as you know now, Lennox, who is her drug dealing maybe boyfriend.
Yeah, oh, that's just gross.
Yeah, well, he's like older than her, and he's kind of a gross guy, though Murr thinks that he makes pretty good jokes. But let's jump back to Billy, because he's the one who distracts Barton Langridge and gets him out of the room so that Carol can talk to Sherry about her concerns. Because Barton, for some reason, doesn't seem like he wants his daughter's disappearance to become like public knowledge, which is pretty weird, pretty crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe he sees it for what it is. Mm. Well, maybe Barton knows about it. Maybe Barton either has figured it out or knows that it's a whole sham. And so I don't know. It's
what do you think about the two of them as characters though? What do you think they kind of fit in the story itself?
I think Sherry is a very sympathetic character. I feel like she's sort of married up into Barton's family and sort of gotten more than what she bargained for from him. I think Barton's a real piece of work. Aoife's done a really great job in portraying that, you know, with the descriptions of the house. And I just want to, just as an aside, like really, really great visual language in this book. I've highlighted a couple of passages that...
Do you have a favorite passage?
There was one. Oh yeah, there we go. Neutrals of every hue competed with each other to be the most tasteful in describing the interior of the Langridge house. And I thought, I can see exactly what you mean.
There's a discussion here about class as well, which I think is pretty neat because it does take a town and we've got characters from all different walks of life kind of contributing to the solving of the mystery, right? The Langridges, like, they're the richest people in town, basically. And it is something that Lennox, even though we've talked about him as kind of a distasteful character, he's brought up that if Jazz is found and Lennox is exposed, Jazz will be just fine, but Lennox will be thrown under the bus. Much in the same way as Nate, who's a character we haven't really talked about much, but he was part of a climate protest that Jazz and Vanessa were setting up in the school. And long story short, Nate took the rap for that one as well. So I feel like we're seeing a sort of history repeats itself situation here where Lennox and Nate, these men who are of lower status to Jazz and Vanessa, kind of being maybe thrown under the bus. How do you feel about that kind of theme there?
I think it's just a great commentary by Aoife on, you know, I think activism in general. You've got the rich kid who feels very strongly about an issue and lower socioeconomic people who gather around her crusade. and tend to take the fall. It's a comment on class in the context of activism, I think.
I wonder if maybe the intent is that Jazz is sort of becoming the next Vanessa. I think we should talk about the friendship that's at the heart of this novel, because as we said, we sort of see Frankie's life crumbling around her. And that's because she's been accused of sending threatening letters to Vanessa before she died. And maybe that contributed to her death, or it was a sign of it.
Her fingerprint has been found on the back of the letters of the threatening letter sent in for a forensic investigation, which is quite incriminating indeed for old Frankie.
The letters are made from cut up letters from magazines. Frankie puts it together because she's a smart cookie that these magazines were the ones that she'd been sending to her. I don't know where it is exactly.
It's her mother's magazines.
Her mother's magazines. There you go.
So it's her mother's magazines, and Mer went to Dez's place to get the magazines and was sort of colluding with Dez on this.
Yeah. So he kind of knew what was going on, but Mer is the one who's actually, you know, put these letters together. And we have this really great sequence of events in the way that the novel is kind of put together, because we have the scene where obviously, and this is part of the broader structure, right? Where all these characters know little pieces of information and we're going to slowly put them together. And we see characters acting with their own biases and perspectives. So we see Frankie blow up at Mer for having created these threatening letters. But this is before we find out, of course, that Frankie's husband, Joe, has been in an affair with Vanessa before she died. And so we only learn after going along the ride with Frankie of this outrage and this betrayal of her best friend, that her betrayal was only created by the catalyst that was her husband's greater betrayal.
It's another one of Frankie's misinformed assumptions, which I think is becoming a bit of a theme.
But we do see, obviously, that Mer, she decides to take the fall when Frankie is blaming her for all the bad things that are going on in her life. Mer says, yep, it was all me. I made those letters because I was jealous, and that's the only reason. And I definitely don't know about your husband's infidelity, right?
Even though she's on the chopping block, Mer continues to be a loyal friend to Frankie, to not pile on more awful things onto her.
And obviously, like, it's a very calculated sequence of events. There's a lot going on here, but watching this kind of unfold and watching Mer be kind of vindicated, even though she's a total screw up in the mind of society, she validates herself in the eyes of the reader.
She continues to be the most honest and pure character in the book, despite the way that the town looks at her.
She might be my favorite character, although we should shout out Danny.
Oh, huge shout out to Danny.
As the best boy.
Best boy, indeed. I just want to say on Danny, at the end of chapter 19, where Carol and Billy interrogate Frankie in her office, I wrote a note down and I just wanted to give myself a pat on the back. I said, Danny wrote the notes using Frankie's magazines because he found out Joe was sleeping with Vanessa.
Oh.
I was so close. That one.
Unfortunately, there are no points to that mystery because it's already been revealed, but...
I know. I'm giving myself good work. Cameron point for
a
myself.
Small, yeah, there you go. Look, you can have that. That doesn't go on the official record, but that's good for you. Yeah, no. And we should also probably mention, as Danny is the best character, because he's the one who actually is, again, honest with Frankie and tells her about his dad's affair, which is wild.
And stands up to his dad. Like, there was a bit of a tense showdown between those two guys, and he held his own. Like, he's, what, 16? And his dad's like screaming at him to shut up, and he's like staring him down like a bullfighter.
Who knows how long this affair has been, or at least how long he's known about this affair been going on. And you have to assume that even if Joe thought he was doing something acceptable, it's doing damage to his kid, and now it's doing damage to his relationship.
Yeah, talking about how Frankie realizes why Danny had been so sullen for however long it had been, and it's just so sad. It's just heartbreaking, honestly, just to see this sort of family crumble. Joe's a real piece of work as well, I gotta say.
It's interesting. Well, let me put it this way. I don't know if I'd say crumble, in that I feel like Danny and Ollie, the two kids, are still firmly in their mother's court. So it's more like one of the pillars of the house is just... is falling apart.
Is rotten. It's full of termites.
Joe's full of termites. You heard it here first.
Joe is full of termites, yeah.
Well, I think that'll do us for our discussion on the general story. So we will see you again in part three for the discussion of who the killer is and what's going on. Cam, I'm really looking forward to your theory in that part of the show. But for now, stick around. You'll see the Death of the Reader on 2SCR 107.3. You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is Herds with a continuation of my chat with Aoife Clifford, author of It Takes a Town, from last time on the show. Now, I want to ask, Mer is a really great character because she's deeply compelling as that screw-up underdog, but we can also kind of laugh at the messes she makes and those darkly ironic comments that she thinks up. What do you think it is about the bad decisions, I guess, that your characters make that keeps us smiling even when we see them dig themselves deeper into the hole?
It's interesting because we're interested in other people's failures. And sometimes we're interested because we feel a very human attachment to it. And sometimes, and even in Mer and Frankie's relationship, part of the appeal for Mer is it makes Frankie feel better about her life, because Frankie's got everything going on in her life and there's Mer, who life's a lot messier. And so it can make you feel a bit superior, which is not an excellent part of human nature, but it nevertheless is present. So I think it's that particularly very Australian is we want to go for the underdog. So we love to see the underdog win as well. So it's complicated. I think part of it is superiority. Part of it is identification. It's interesting because even this week I was seeing another author sort of talking about, you know, if you want to pitch yourself for podcasts, really be upfront about your failures, because everyone's far more interested in your failures than your successes, which, I mean, I found that interesting because that's not necessarily what I'm interested in listening to. I don't know if successes is quite what it is, but there is something very human about feeling even someone who you might look up to as successful, that there is a bumbling an idiot. They're a Watson as much as you are, perhaps. So it is. It's a very human response, I think, for good and for bad, that we like to look at someone in trouble and either put ourselves in that position in empathy, sympathy, or feel slightly superior.
Yeah. I think it's interesting hearing you talk about the ways that if writers, you know, want to be published, want to get on podcasts, you know, you need to interact with that balance of being both vulnerable and professional, I guess, in the way that you've written Vanessa in the book, because she tries very hard to be seen as this untouchable, mythic, you know, dancing goddess on a sugar snap cookie. I guess I'm just curious about that idea of the myth and of characters trying to kind of, because Ivan Roland and Barton do it too, where they're trying to maintain their professional image. I guess I'm just curious about why you feel the need to throw those characters under the bus. You know, let's go with that.
Well, Roland, that's a good point, actually. The ones who are trying to be most competent and professional, the ones I'm the nastiest.
Outwardly nasty. Not in a, like, they probably did the murder way, but in a, they're just awful human beings, regardless of if they did it or not.
But the thing is, there are awful human beings out there, and particularly with Barton, there were some politicians in particular that I was going, yeah, mate, yeah, you really, really annoy me in real life. It's going into the book. And also sometimes then to subvert a bit, to set up in a certain way, and this is something I really enjoyed doing. We've sort of talked already about, you know, you've got Carol as you would think the classic cop who's going to be the main character of the book, but she's not. You've got we referenced Janet earlier, but we haven't really talked about her much, but she's kind of the Miss Marple character that you would expect, but that's not quite how it turns out either. So I love taking those sort of classic tropes of crime, your usual crime characters, and then subverting them a little bit.
No, I think that subversion angle is obviously really powerful. Janet, You say she's Miss Marple. I see her as every old lady in a murder mystery who secretly knows exactly what's going on, but nobody talks to them. Except that Janet is always talking to people, but she doesn't tell them anything like directly useful.
as Carol, the police officer. So Janet is the type of character who has got a list of suspects put in her winter coat pocket just in case she's ever found murdered. And Carol, the police officer, can see why Janet would get murdered. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to, Janet I really loved, but I wanted to at the start as well, as a bit of, and this is why Carol doesn't believe that it's a murder at the start, is that the people who are saying it, it's a murder, are kind of the powerless. And I was kind of interested in that sort of generations of power that we've got. Essentially, the baby boomers going into Gen X, maybe slightly millennials, they're the people who kind of are running the town and all the important positions of power here. So if you're above that in the generation above, you're not really getting listened to, and you're certainly not getting listened to if you're 15 and 16, which is a couple of other characters that we haven't mentioned. But it's the generation above and the generation below that when you're sort of the ones without power, you're also probably the most observant because you're having to work out who's in power and how do I get my way when I'm actually quite powerless.
I've been calling them Scooby Gang, the kids, Jazz and Brianna and Danny and others. I love that the kids, because as always, it takes a town and all kinds of people in the town. You know, you got to find a place for the young kids to make a difference. So these young kids, they have a really great time solving piece of the mystery and kind of acting above what we expected them. I think Danny in particular, though they all kind of have their own moment in the sun. I'd like to know how you went about making the Scooby-Doo gang hijinks of the school kids meaningful, you know, giving them a place and a stake in the plot, allowing to uncover things while still kind of keeping it realistic. I'd love to know about that.
Yeah, it was really fun to write. I mean, and you always think about the great writers that you like to borrow from. In particular, there's a couple of things that I actually saw Mick Herron do in his fantastic series that I thought, oh, that's interesting. And can I take that little bit of a device and pull it even further? So part of it, I always, for whatever reason, I really do love writing about teenagers. My first book, the main character was a teenager. My second book, there's a whole teenage section that sort of it's in the past, but the past is teenagers and then present day is adults. And I think that might get back to what you were alluding before about childhood being so important and it always stays with you, that time of life when you're kind of furious that, you know, you're getting thwarted at every turn by the adults around you to actually do what you want to do. And you're seeing that the adults aren't that great. Like they're stuffing up, they're making mistakes, they're being boring. And there's that energy of you want to change the world. Now, particularly Jazz is very much into that because she is the local politician's stepdaughter. So she is just disgusted with him. He's one of the reprehensible people we're talking about earlier. So she's got good reason, quite frankly. So she is, and also it's the state of the world. Like it's sort of like if I was a teenager now, I'd be furious too. I mean, I'm an adult and I'm furious half the time, you know. So if you're a teenager, go, what is this? Like we are getting such a raw deal. And I really wanted to do that. I wanted to talk about, like I wanted to, it's not the main part at all, but Jazz represents it a lot, you know. She's trying to do her climate change protest. She's trying to stop her stepfather's reprehensible actions and, you know, these draconian new protest laws that are being brought in. Amidst the jokes, there's some, you know, serious stuff that's not the main focus, but it's there because in life it's there as well, is that they're sort of going, you know, you guys are doing a terrible job. Get out of the way and let us do it. And so part of that is seeing you're not solving anything. If we want this solved, we're going to have to do it ourselves. And that's like in one sense, that's a funny position to take. But in another sense, it's an absolutely logical position to take, is that just, yeah, get out of my way. And Jazz, more so than the others, but the other two as well, is like, yep, I've got this. I'm going to solve what's going on.
Thank you very much for coming on the show to chat with me, Aoife. And you can, of course, pick up a copy of this brand new Town Sensation Murder Mystery and give a go at solving it for yourself. Stay tuned for Cam's second attempt at locking in an answer to the question, who killed Vanessa Walton? Stick around. You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is Herds and Cam. He's also here. We're still covering It Takes a Town by Aoife Clifford, chapters 12 to 24. That's the one. And Cam, you're in the hot seat today. It's like a lava bed you're sitting on right now. I need you to tell me about Vanessa's murder. I'd say also Jazz's kidnapping, but maybe that's something we can talk about as we go. There's obviously some connections there. Jazz is convinced that she knows who killed Vanessa, how and why, and it was also all of her fault. So I'm excited to hear you tell me about how that works.
Aoife Clifford's just keeping me on edge. Like telling me that there's information, but you're not actually telling me what the information is.
Apparently there is a bag in Jazz's parents' cupboard. I don't know that you know what's in the bag, but apparently it is a key piece of evidence for some reason. And there is a lot of suspicion around the Langridge family. So I guess, do you want to start talking about them? Because there's many different things I want you to explain. And particularly how Ivan Roland is the culprit as well. That's the main thing I want to know about.
There's a chapter from Brianna's point of view where she thinks there's a break-in occurring as she's sitting in the kitchen eating ice cream. And she immediately goes, Ivan Roland. And I took it as face value and I just wrote, what is this guy's problem?
No, because
It turns out it was
well, it's actually Danny. And I mean, that's one of the very fun sequences in this novel that we get to watch Brianna and Danny, and to some extent Jazz, go on their little Scooby-Doo adventure.
Yeah, doing their little detective work, yeah.
Like, obviously they've got their familiar problems, mostly for Danny, but watching the school kids be like, all right, we figured out Jazz fated disappearance. She would never leave her phone behind. That's crazy. We need to go after her. And they like drive around town, knocking on doors. It's fantastic.
They end up at Lennox's place, which is kind of cool.
We don't see what happens in the house. We just know that they've been to see Lennox.
Because Ben, as we know, it takes a town. It takes a town.
It takes a whole town. Every brick, a piece of the road.
The grass, the dogs, everyone.
All right, Cam, I need to know, what does the grass tell you about the murder? Let's get in on this. What's going on with Vanessa?
All right.
Who's killed her, how and why?
We've gotten some new information about Vanessa and the whereabouts of certain objects during the lead up to her death. So we now know that Vanessa was indeed planning on running against Barton Langridge in the election and seemed to be a little bit more of a threat than he initially thought.
Yeah, she was planning on using her kind of small town popularity and maybe the media. The media is a big part of this story, obviously. Her using that against Barton with all of his real estate money.
A welcome change.
Yes, a welcome change. That's the one. That's her slogan.
So that's one thing. We know that Vanessa came to Barton's office in town.
Yeah, I think Yvette, who's like his
assistant. Yeah, I think so.
She was on the helicopter ride on the way to the town, actually. So she's fun to kind of pop up again. But
she confirmed that she came there with the bottle of champagne. Barton was not available at the time. And so she went home. So maybe she did indeed drink that glass of champagne. There was one or two glasses there. I can't remember in the.
I don't recall. Yeah. I don't recall.
But yeah, so that's an interesting development. Vanessa was a part of the climate change demonstration.
Yes, she hid in the classroom when Billy found them. Billy like let Jazz and Vanessa go, so Nate took the rap. I guess my question is, like, do all roads lead to Barton Langridge?
I'm still not convinced. I feel like it's either too obvious or it's a clever double bluff. In that making it so obvious it's Barton, that making me think that it's not Barton, but it really is Barton behind it all.
Well, that's part of the fun. You're enjoying the Herd's conundrum where I see two distinct possibilities and I have to pick the right one.
There's three running threads in my head, if I may divulge them.
Yeah, please tell me about the threads.
The first one being that Barton Langridge got rid of Vanessa because he wanted to get rid of a political opponent. The second one being Joe, who killed Vanessa because she was going to tell Frankie about their affair.
That would certainly compound the drama around Frankie's crumbling household.
Yes, yes. And he even says that he went to her place the night she died, but she didn't answer when he knocked on the door. And I think there's only one person who can confirm that for us, and that is our dear friend, the spider, Janet.
Follow the money, you know.
Follow the money. I've got that highlighted as something to remember, as something important, because it pertains to my third thread. And that is still that it may have been something to do with Vanessa's family, maybe Dolly, to do with embezzling money. Dolly doesn't really seem too cut up about it. She's going about her business, sort of using the death of Vanessa to drum up publicity for the dance studio.
And she seems to be annoyed because we get a scene between her and Beth where she talks about how Lonnie is going to get the money for the house now that Vanessa's dead. And she's really annoyed about that.
And how she's going to sell the Palais, and Beth thinking to herself, well, probably would have been a good idea to sell the Palais so they can build a proper dance studio. And then she also mentions that Vanessa had been thinking about selling the Palais in the first place. So Vanessa's always going after money. That seems to be a main motivator, which is also interesting to do with her decision to run for office, not because of the platform and not because she wants to make a difference. The reason that she ends up deciding to do it is because Jazz tells her about the pay and super benefits that politicians get, which seems to prick up her ears, which falls into my episode one theory that Vanessa has a drug problem. Here's my thinking. I don't think the Barton-Langridge thread goes anywhere because Janet saw Barton banging on Vanessa's door at about 6 o'clock and she didn't answer. So I think we can assume that she may have died by then. You know what? I'm still sticking with the familial violence and money thing.
So who's done a murder then?
Who's done a murder?
And remember that if you chose Dolly last week, in order to get one of your 3 points, you need to provide at least an alternate theory, although I will be asking you to choose between the two of them. So what are you going with this week? Who's your killer and how?
Okay. I've got my why. My how, I think, still taking advantage of the fact that maybe she may have gotten a bit tipsy on that champagne, which was left open. I think the how is that she was pushed down the stairs. The way that the crime scene was set up still feels very theatrical to me to make it look like an accident. But the whom, that's an interesting question.
It is. It's the question.
Joe's a tall guy, right? Quite a tall guy.
Maybe, yeah.
He could have reached the light to take the light out of the ceiling.
He's a practical guy.
This is the tricky one, isn't it?
I know. Look, this is the hard part. Look, I've been doing this for 5 years now. Our fifth anniversary is coming up next week, actually, which I'm really excited for. Flex and I will be having a chat about that next week in some detail. But this is always the hardest part, is when you feel like you're just on the tip of understanding what's going on in the novel, but you're not quite sure how to pin it down with certainty. This is the struggle that Flex and I, mostly I, go through when trying to solve these books. So I don't envy you.
On one side, I've got Joe. He's got the motivation. He was having an affair with Vanessa and he may have gotten wind or was told explicitly by Vanessa that she was going to tell Frankie about it and he didn't want that getting out. So he went there on the night of the storm, pushed her down the stairs and made it look like an accident. On the other hand, I've got Dolly and, you know what, even I think I'm going to loop Beth into this. I feel she might be crying crocodile tears at the end of that most recent chapter. I'm going to be cruel.
Maybe.
I'm going to be cruel.
Sure.
But I think more likely Dolly. She seems pretty vindictive.
Your two decisions here, you've got Dolly as the direct familial connection.
Yes.
And then you've got Joe for sex reasons. Which one do you think is the more likely theory of the two? Lock in an answer for me. Coward, pick one.
I'm going to lock in Joe. I'm locking in Joe. I'm locking in Joe.
Locking in Joe is your answer?
Yeah, okay, cool. I'm going to kick myself if it's not Joe.
We'll lock in Joe, pushing Vanessa down the stairs for sexy time reasons.
Yeah, taking the light bulb out of the roof and filling a bucket of water.
With his giant arms and making it look like an accent through his theatrical leanings. Awesome. Well, thank you very much for playing. We will, of course, be back next week with more of It Takes a Town by Aoife Clifford with parts 25 to the end. Thank you for attempting to solve, Cam. It's been great.
I can't wait to be proven wildly wrong.
Look, I'm excited for you to be 100% right. It might still happen. You're listening to Death of the Reader on 2SER 107.3, and we will see you in the next video.
See you then.
Episode. There's no video.
There's no video.
Stay tuned.